Good. All right. So let me start by thanking the organizers, Kurt, especially for the invitation to speak here. It's always nice to be in Santa Barbara. Unfortunately, I have to apologize for the fact that I'm going to have to leave right after lunch. I'm due to speak at a workshop on path integrals in Toulouse, France, and I have to be there by Wednesday morning. So I'm going to be cutting out right after lunch, which is too bad because this looks like a really great workshop. But it certainly is a pleasure for me to speak here and to talk a little bit about what we're doing in the area of exploring complex energy landscapes to try to predict free energies for complex molecules and crystalline polymorphs, and to maybe think about ways that we can use these enhanced sampling techniques as a way of doing some coarse graining, perhaps. Let me start out actually by showing a very simple molecular dynamics movie of a short peptide chain that's going to fold into a little beta hairpin. Now, this is a very straightforward type of simulation. We have a little trick in here where we scale the masses of the water molecules and we scale the masses of the side chains just to enhance the sampling a little bit. And under these conditions, we're able to get one folding event, which is actually kind of nice. All right, well, let's look at that again. And so you see that the chain twists and moves around a lot and folds and unfolds a little bit. But finally, you get one event to the folded state. And this is after something like, 10 nanoseconds for whatever time means in the scaled mass type of simulation. So it's nice that you can produce a folding event, but this is really not what you're after. All right? When you want to explore a complex energy landscape, when you want to predict free energies, remember, free energy in statistical mechanics is related to probability. And probability means you must sample the distribution extensively. You really need to know what the relative probabilities are in different basins of attraction, and then to be able to compare those in order to get a free energy. And one folding event is not going to do that for you. What we're really after is a conformational equilibrium. So I'm showing you that here. Another little example is, in this case, a polyalanine chain that's going to fold into a helix from this random coil configuration. And you want to be able to go back and forth between these states and whatever intermediate states there are on the energy landscape many times so that you can really get a sense of what the populations are in these different basins. And the paradigm that people often refer to in this kind of problem is the rough energy landscape. Okay, and I particularly like this rough energy landscape because it comes from a recent trip that I took to Brazil and took this nice photograph. And so you can see that what's going on here is you have lots and lots of hills and valleys, and this is sort of an analog of what your energy landscape might look like if you could blow it out to many, many, many dimensions, which is, of course, what you've got. So you want to walk over these hills, go into the valleys, explore those. If these hills have some meaning, then you might be able to even predict some transition states there. But exploration of this landscape is, of course, a very, very difficult problem because typically these barriers are high on the order of KT for your simulations. So it takes a long time to cross them, and you're faced with what's known as the rare event problem. Okay, here's another example of what you'd really like to be able to produce in this kind of calculation. So this is a little coarse grain model of a protein that folds into a beta barrel structure. And again, what you'd like to see is to be able to go back and forth between these structures many times and visit whatever intermediate states there are on the way. So what you're looking at here is three types of simulations for this system. This black one here is just an ordinary molecular dynamics calculation, which never really uses a record of the energy. So you can see that the energy really doesn't change very much on that time scale. The red one in this case is a replica exchange simulation, which actually does better. And the blue one is a very aggressive sampling technique that I'm not going to have time to talk about today, but one that we published a few years ago in the Science Journal. And it's one that actually allows you to produce many, many, many folding and unfolding events, albeit with some mathematical complexity. But this is what you'd really like to see, okay? You're going into the folded state, you come out. You go into it, you come out, and you can start to see a particular neighborhood of structures, which look like these, as it turns out, being very well populated in your energy record. And so, you know, if you run this long enough, you'd probably be able to say that that is the structure that is the lowest free energy structure, because you've been able to sample the probability well enough. Okay. Now, often, when you want to characterize a free energy landscape, you are interested in maybe choosing a couple of variables that we call collective variables, and using those, if they're well chosen, to characterize the key conformations. And so a typical thing, for example, might be you take a dipeptide, in this case this is NATMA, N-acetyltryptophan methylamide, and what you might use in something like this, the typical Ramachandran angles. And so what this is producing for you, if I can get this moving to go, okay, and you see it, is a lot of sampling on this landscape. And so as you populate the different structures, and you'll see extended structures, you'll see helical structures, they all go by very quickly because we're passing through them many, many, many times. And overall, you build up a picture of the probability distribution, which you can turn then into this free energy landscape in these two variables. And so this is a kind of coarse graining that we typically use when we want to study the conformations, because you can't look at the full 3n-dimensional probability distribution function. Okay, so this is the kind of thing that we're after, but obviously for more complex systems than ultimately than dipeptides. Okay, it takes a while for this to transition, but the slide that's coming up, I think, is one that also addresses or is characteristic of the rough energy landscape problem, which is polymorphism in molecular crystals. Okay, so here's a typical example. This is a famous case of this anti-AIDS drug Norvir, or ritonavir, which was released to the market in 1996. And in 1998, they had to recall the drug because large lots of it were failing the dissolution test, okay, so they weren't soluble. And of course, if it's not soluble, it's not bioavailable. So they took it off the market, and they went back and tried to figure out what was going on. And it turns out that this molecule here, the fact was not known in 1996, but it's polymorphic. And there was another structure, another crystal structure, that had gotten into the manufacturing process, and then was turning up in the batches that ultimately led to this recall, all right? And presumably, this was a more stable structure that it had transformed to, and therefore was less soluble. So they had to go back and look at the synthesis procedure, and finally, they came up with one that was able to isolate the bioavailable form and not the other one, and they were able to re-release the drug in 2002, but of course at a great cost to the company, and of course there's a lot of embarrassment associated with this kind of a recall. Okay, another famous example is a very well-known drug, ranitidine, or Zantac as it's well-known, which is just something that you take for common heartburn. And this also has a couple of different polymorphs, both of which are bioavailable. And this thing, it turns out, led to a series of patent disputes. The original manufacturer of this drug, which is Glaxo, had a patent on one of the polymorphs, and then they discovered another one, and they had a patent on that. But there was some kind of mistake in their original patent, and so as soon as that patent was set to expire, of course, the generic drug makers came in and said they wanted to get in on this, and so they tried to make the original form, following the directions in the patent, and they ended up with the second one. So they said, look, the second one is actually not novel. It would be covered by this first patent, because that's what you get when you follow the synthetic procedure. And so since that patent is expired, you don't have a monopoly on any of these polymorphs anymore, so we can go ahead and make our generic version. Well, of course, there was suit and countersuit about this, and finally the courts came down on the side of the generic drug maker and said, you're right, patent has expired, it's not covered, so you can go ahead and make your generic form. And so when you go into the drugstore and you look for Zantac, you will also see the generic form of this drug. Okay, and because this is such a widely used drug, and that monopoly was lost, this is called the billion-dollar polymorph. All right, so sampling crystalline polymorphs and sampling complex molecules such as polypeptides all turn out to be an aspect of trying to sample things on a rough energy landscape. And so I'm going to tell you about a method that we've been working on, which we call adiabatic free energy dynamics, which is a way to produce these free energy landscapes in a small set of collective variables. All right? And so we're going to assume that we have some set of variables of interest. Now, the problem of choosing these is, of course, a challenge in and of itself, and one that I'm not going to be able to address in this talk. But nevertheless, let's suppose that we have these, and we think that they characterize the conformations of interest on our landscape. Okay, so we'll say we have little n of these things, n is a small number compared to 3n, and what we're interested in producing is the probability distribution function for these variables to have certain values, which we'll call s. All right, and so classically what that means is you need to integrate over the Boltzmann factor and then look at the intersection of all the hypersurfaces that express this fact that these variables should have certain values, right? Now, this can still be a relatively high-dimensional object, and so you can either try to map it all out in all these degrees of freedom, or you might be able to assume some sort of a functional form for this and then use enhanced sampling to parameterize it. Either way, what you need to address is how do we sample this this reduced partition function. So let's suppose I can go into a set of variables in which these Qs are explicit. Now, that's not always going to be easy or even possible, but if these are simple geometric variables, for example, internal dihedral angles or centers of mass of certain parts of your molecule, then this is actually easy to do. You might get a Jacobian factor, so you can absorb that factor into the Hamiltonian. And so what you end up with is a kind of effective Hamiltonian that looks like this. Now, the way that we enhance the sampling then is we introduce a temperature for these collective variables that we'll call TS. And this TS needs to be much larger than the physical temperature, just to ensure that you can get over the barriers on this subset of your energy landscape. All right, now that's going to affect your thermodynamics. So we have an additional condition, which is adiabatic decoupling between these variables and all the other degrees of freedom in your system. Now, under these conditions, if you're adiabatically decoupled and running at high temperature in this subspace, you can show that if you take the log of the distribution that you generate under these adiabatic conditions and multiply by the high temperature, you basically get the free energy at the physical temperature, right? Okay, so that's really nice, and I'm going to show you an example of that. But one of the difficulties associated with this is the fact that you need to be able to make this transformation to a set of variables where the Qs are explicit, and that's not always easy to do, and it's rather painful. So, if you're willing to sacrifice a little bit of accuracy, there's a way to get around this. And this is a method that was actually first introduced by Eric van den Einden and Luca Marliano. We were working on it independently at the time, but we came along a little bit later with our publication. But the basic idea is this. Let's suppose you have, again, these n variables of interest. Again, this is what you have to calculate, this distribution function. And what you can do in this case to avoid these transformations is to simply represent these delta functions, which are causing all the problems, as Gaussians. Okay, if you take the limit that the widths of these Gaussians go to zero, or in this case, if you take the inverse width up here, going to infinity, you reproduce the exact distribution function. Right? But if you introduce these Gaussians, then you can pull them into the Hamiltonian, and you get a kind of a Hamiltonian with this harmonic coupling between some variables S and your physical variables. So to move these Gaussian centers around and make sure that you're sampling that part of your landscape, you can introduce here a set of uncoupled Gaussian integrals in the form of these P's that will pretend are conjugate to these S's. All right? So we introduce it as a kind of kinetic energy. And now what I have is an extended phase space Hamiltonian that looks like this. And I'm going to do molecular dynamics on that Hamiltonian with this effective harmonic coupling that has a very stiff harmonic constant here. Okay, and again, now we introduce the adiabatic conditions on our extended space. So we have this high temperature for the extended variables and high masses for them. So these would be the equations of motion that you would need to integrate. Your physical variables are coupled to a heat bath at your physical temperature, but these extended variables are now heated and they're slowed down. And so the same kinds of arguments are used now to show that the distribution that you get comes is this adiabatic one, and if you take the log of that, at the limit that these constants become very large, you can reproduce, again, the exact free energy landscape. Okay, so let me just show you a little example of this. This is a visual example. We haven't done all the analysis on this, but it just shows roughly how it works. So this is an alanine decamer in the gas phase, and our collective variables will be all the backbone dihedral angles, okay, which we heat to 900 Kelvin. Physical temperature is near 300 Kelvin, and then we take this mass, all right, which gives us pretty good adiabatic decoupling and this harmonic constant. And so let's just have a look at what a typical type of adiabatic simulation of this sort of looks like. So this is the motion of your alanine decamer, and you can see that it goes in and out of the helical state many, many times. Okay, and it explores other conformations as it does. We'll come out of this example, some sort of probably beta structure, random coil structure, some mismatched beta structure, and it finds its way back into the helical structure. So you're sampling this basin many times and intermediate states as well. And so if you plot a record, for example, of the RMSD to the folded helical state, this is the black curve is our adiabatic simulation, and the red curve is ordinary MD, and these are just four different independent simulations. So the MD, you can see, is very different in all of these. If you start in the folded state, you'll stay there. If you're lucky, you might find it once in a typical trajectory, but we only found it once. Whereas the adiabatic simulation is able to find the state many times, and if you do the analysis of this energy landscape, which we haven't done yet, we hope to be able to find the relative free energy difference between the folded and unfolded states for this thing. Okay, so that's analysis that's yet to be done, but let's see how we can adapt this to crystalline polymorphs. And here we have a very nice obvious set of collective variables, namely the box matrix. Okay, so we take the box lengths and angles, or equivalently the three vectors that characterize a box, you collect them into a 3x3 matrix called the box matrix. And this is the dynamical object that you would put into a sort of a typical constant pressure algorithm. All right, so this is one that's shown here. This is the Martina-Tobias-Klein algorithm. There's not much that you need to know about this, except that you see that there's an equation of motion for the box that's coupled to a kind of momentum variable, which we call a barostat, because what drives the evolution of this variable is simply the instantaneous difference between the applied pressure and the internal pressure tensor estimator, right? And this is the thing that we're going to heat to a high temperature, which will make the box move quickly, and then we have a mass which is very large to make it adiabatically decoupled from everything else. Okay, so an example of this kind of scheme is one that we did on solid benzene, which actually has a lot of polymorphs. And what we're producing here is simply the Gibbs, if you will, the Gibbs energy landscape in this set of box parameters. All right, so our simulations are carried out at 300K, but the box itself is at 30,000 Kelvin, right? And this is our pressure, this number of molecules. And if we run basically just 500 picoseconds over a set of 9 independent trajectories, so this is the total time, we're actually able to visit all of the crystalline polymorphs. If you run 10 times longer, you have enough information to get some rough free energies. Okay. We're not the first ones to study solid benzene. Obviously, this is from a previous paper by the Parinello group, and they produced a sort of putative phase diagram of benzene based on both theoretical and experimental structures, and you can see that there's a lot of them. Many of them are known from experiments, some of them are more speculative. The interesting one in this phase diagram actually turns out to be right in here, this benzene 2 structure, right? Because there's an ongoing controversy about this. A number of different techniques have produced different ideas as to what this structure ought to be. All right, so simple lattice minimization gives you two structures which are sort of pure benzene 2, and then there's an MD simulation out there which yielded what's called 201, which is basically a kind of mixed benzene 2, benzene 3 structure, right? And it turns out that this one is a better match to experiment than the pure benzene 2, but there's no explanation as to why that is. And so this has remained a controversial issue as to why that is so. All right? And without having free energies available, that's very difficult to resolve. But with our technique, you can actually get that. So this is what a typical simulation looks like using this method with the adiabatically decoupled box. And if you watch this evolve, you'll see it go from one solid structure to another. And you might visit certain structures numerous times if they're more favorable than others. But you'll visit a number of different solid structures as this thing goes on in time. I'm not sure I want to spend too much time looking at this, but just to give you an idea of some of the transformations that you see. Okay, so there's another one, for example. And as you watch this, you visit a variety of other structures. Okay, so let's move on. So now you can analyze the full six-dimensional free energy surface that you get in the box parameters, and you can do that using clustering techniques. And what you reproduce at the end of the day is a kind of probability distribution for the different crystal structures that you visit, right? There's one which is benzene 4, which is actually not seen on here because it's actually not stable in our simulation, so it's sort of a saddle point. We do visit it, but it has negligible population in our distribution function. Okay, the most important thing to look at here is what happens around benzene 2. All right, so this is pure benzene 2, and it has a nice low lattice energy, which is what's shown in the red. But the free energy is shown in green, and you can see that the free energy is actually quite high compared to this 2-3 mixture. This is the 2-0-1, or what we now call 3 with a defect. It is basically benzene 3 with a line defect that looks like benzene 2. And that actually has a low free energy, which you see here. And that was the one that actually gave a better match to the powder diffraction data. And so that sort of resolves the controversy, because it shows that that's the one that you're going to visit more often than pure benzene 2 because of this free energy difference, right? Presumably what's causing this difference is that this is a very low entropy structure and this is a higher entropy structure. Okay, so I have a few minutes left. We're doing more with crystal structures, but I'm not going to get into that now. I want to show you the latest development of our adiabatic technique. Now, let's compare adiabatic dynamics, as I showed it, with another very popular technique that people use, which is called metadynamics. All right, many people know metadynamics. The way metadynamics works is, let's say you're moving on this rough energy landscape, and what you do is you start where you are, and you begin populating the basin with Gaussian functions. Okay? And as you fill this basin, what will happen in time is that you'll make a transition to the next one, and then you start populating that. And as you sum all these Gaussians at the end of your trajectory, you basically get the inverse of your free energy landscape. All right? Now, in its purest form, what you have to do, of course, is to wait until you've filled this basin, and then you transit to the next one. And so serially, you're visiting all the basins on your energy landscape, of course. There have been a lot of developments in metadynamics, and they've gone beyond this simple picture, but this is what it sort of was in its original form. Now, let's compare that to the adiabatic scheme, which basically gives you a quick sweep of your energy landscape. So you visit the basins rather quickly, you get these sweeps of the whole landscape, and so you can get a pretty quick map of what your free energy minima are. If you wanted to converge the whole surface, you'd probably have to wait about the same time here and here. But if you want a quick measure of your free energy minima, this will get it to you somewhat faster than this because of these sweeps over the whole energy landscape. Nevertheless, there's no reason not to combine these things. They work in different ways, and that orthogonality between them actually could work synergistically. So we've come up with a way of basically combining our adiabatic scheme with metadynamics. And we call this biased adiabatic dynamics. And since it unifies the adiabatic and metadynamics and some other things, we actually call it unified free energy dynamics. And so here's the way it works. There's our adiabatic scheme sweeping over the landscape. But what we're going to do is, as we move over, we're going to build up a picture of a bias potential, which we will construct in the spirit of metadynamics by simply throwing some Gaussians down wherever we are. So they're going to be delocalized because we're sweeping over the landscape. We're just going to throw a Gaussian where we are and then build up this bias potential. We're not going to use the Gaussians to reconstruct the free energy. All right? That's going to come directly from either the histogram or by doing force calculations. So this is only a way to help us sample better. Okay. So The Hamiltonian that you would have now will include this bias that you're generating, which actually is time dependent. And if you want to get the energy landscape from your probability distribution function, all you have to do is subtract out the bias at the end of the day. Or we found that another very nice way of doing this, a very efficient way, is to use the mean force. All right. Now, in the adiabatic scene, the mean force is really easy to calculate. It's just this Hooke's law thing. It comes from the derivative of your harmonic term. So there are no weird Jacobians or anything like that to worry about. You just use that expression up there, and that is indeed the derivative of your distribution function. And so what you can do, for example, one way you can tackle the reconstructing the free energy from this is to use a simple basis set expansion. If the dimensionality is not too high, this will be pretty manageable. And so what you would do in this case is you would assume a basis set expansion like this, and you'd use the sampled forces and the actual gradients of this thing to fit the coefficients. That will give you a set of linear equations that you can solve, and then you can reconstruct your free energy from that. Or if you have an analytical form for this, if you think you might know a good form for that, you might be able to parameterize it using your sampling, right? Using sort of force matching ideas. Okay, so let's have a look at how does this compare to metadynamics. All right, so here we're showing our unified scheme with small Gaussians. This is actually the alanine dipeptide in the gas phase, so a very simple system. And we're comparing that with metadynamics using small Gaussians. And as long as the Gaussians are not too high, you can actually get the same answer out of both of them. So they both reproduce the free energy surface, the Ramachandran surface, very well. But one nice thing about not using the Gaussians to reconstruct the free energy, and also using them in the extended space, is that you can use large Gaussians and you get almost no degradation in your free energy at all. All right, so this is really the same as that within the error bars, but I'm using 10 times higher Gaussians, so I'm sampling faster. You try to do that within metadynamics and you really ruin your surface. So metadynamics is very sensitive to the height of the Gaussians that you use. Okay, so if you want to look at how quickly you converge, this is a plot of the convergence as a function of time to the final answer for each method. So this red curve would say be the metadynamics calculation with small Gaussians. The solid curve is our scheme with the small Gaussians. This dashed curve here is our scheme with the large Gaussians. And you can see that you get about an order of magnitude speed up. In fact, if you plot the free energy surface that you get here, it's actually pretty close to converge. You know where all the minima are, and you even get the relative free energies, right? And all you're waiting for here is to converge some of these higher free energy regions. Okay. You can see from the blue curve how well we compare, let's say, with our original just adiabatic scheme, and we even improve upon that. Okay, so this is the same thing for the alanine dipeptide in solution, which one should be able to do as well. Here are all the minima that you get. And again, if you do it with small Gaussians, our scheme and metadynamics match pretty well. But again, if you go to large Gaussians, you degrade the result from metadynamics, whereas here you basically get the same answer. Okay, and this is your convergence plot. So this is, again, metadynamics with the small Gaussians. These dashed curves that you're seeing in red, also in the last one, that's metadynamics with the large Gaussians, and you simply never converge there. Okay, this is our scheme with small Gaussians. The dashed curve is ours with the large Gaussians. And again, it's about an order of magnitude improvement over metadynamics. Okay, here's a somewhat larger system. This is metencephalin, so this is a 5-residue peptide. And what we used were these two sort of coarse dihedral angles between the alpha carbons of these first four residues and then the second four, and then we plot the free energy in that. And this is an interesting example because you see on this landscape basins that are very close together, all right? So 3 and 4, 2 and 1, this is what they look like down here. So there are some beta-like structures, some more helical-like structures. When you have close basins like this, this is called degeneracy. And this is a real problem for certain methods. Now, metadynamics gets tripped up with these degeneracies unless the Gaussians are really, really, really small. Okay, so for example, this is using the same size Gaussian for our scheme and for metadynamics, and here's where you see the degeneracy problem affecting metadynamics. It looks like it's converging until you discover there's another basin there very close by, and then it goes away, and then it finally comes down to this final result. Whereas with our scheme, their degeneracy does affect it a little bit, but early on, and then you're essentially done. Okay, now these are all two-dimensional surfaces, and that's not as impressive as being able to do something of higher dimension. And so the first thing we tried to do was to generate a full four-dimensional surface using the alanine tripeptide in the gas phase. All right? Now since then, we've actually been able to do the alanine tetrapeptide in six dimensions, but I didn't have time to put those results together. Well, let's just see what happens in four dimensions. All right? Now what we're looking at here are, of course, the two Ramachandran dihedral angle pairs. And what I'm plotting here is a projection onto phi 1 psi 1 of the free energy that we get. And this is actually the same thing, but only using phi 1 and psi 1 as the collective variables, not psi 2 and phi 2. And you can see that they actually match pretty well. So this is sort of an independent check. But to have another independent check, we actually ran replica exchange, MD, for a full microsecond. All right? Now, in a microsecond, this is how much of the surface, the four-dimensional surface, you can get. Okay, again, this is a projection onto phi 1, psi 1. So you don't see the full dimensionality here, but this is as much as you can get. All right, so all the region of the free energy landscape above, I think about 2 to 3 kcals per mole, is simply not visited. But it's enough that you can map out a good portion of the minima that we see here. And so what we're comparing in this plot is the minima that both methods found and the difference between them in blue. All right? And basically, the agreement here is actually pretty good. It's within about a half a kcal per mole, which is not too bad given the sampling error. All right? And this is the convergence of our unified scheme down to about 0.2 kcals per mole after 200 nanoseconds compared to the replica exchange, which ran for a full microsecond. All right, so that's our first attempt to get a higher dimensional landscape. As I said, we were also able to do the six-dimensional case, but I didn't have time to prepare those results, but they actually look pretty good as well. So I think I'm at the end of my time, so let's just conclude with a few things. All right, so I've shown you that you have this this adiabatic seam that allows you to explore complex energy landscapes. You can apply it to I showed applications of small peptides into crystalline polymorphs. And so obviously what we want to do in the future is to go to larger larger biomolecules, maybe some drug docking, a wider variety of crystalline polymorphs, and maybe to think about using this kind of enhanced sampling technique, if, as long as you can generate these PMFs, as maybe a way to do some kind of coarse screening. Right? That's all for the future. Thanks for your attention. These are my acknowledgments.
So thanks a lot, and I'm sure there are plenty of questions here already. Let's start here. And
on the crystal polymorphs, the methods you're using, can you put this in context for me in terms of, is this like doing parallel Raman with a very small mass of the piston, so it's going to be flopping around a lot, or is something addition?
Actually, it's just the opposite of that, all right? It's like Parinella Raman, except that the box is hot, so the cell parameters are at high temperature, but the effective mass of that is also very large, so it's adiabatically decoupled. So we're running an adiabatically decoupled scheme of the particles from the cell parameters.
But that, the way I'm thinking about it is that by small mass of the piston, it's responding to pressure fluctuations very quickly, going from one state to the other, whereas yours is doing the same thing. It's moving very quickly.
Well, when you say the piston, we're talking about the, I guess what I call PG, maybe? Is that what we're talking about? It's the barostat, right?
The barostat, right.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, bear with me here. So, yeah, what I'm calling the PG. We're using a very large mass for it because ultimately what we want is to be able to map out a free energy in these parameters. So we need this adiabatic decoupling. So what happens is it's hot, All right, it's 30,000 Kelvin, but it's moving slowly. So it, as it moves, it drives the particles, the molecules, from one structure to another. But because it's moving slowly, the molecules are able to relax into that new structure, and then as it starts to move again, they're now going from one basin to another one where you get another structure. That's the idea.
And my follow-up question quickly is, the assumption here with the polymorphs is that these distortions of the box will get you all of the relevant crystal structures.
Ah, okay. So that is, of course, an excellent question. And you're right. The box matrix alone may not be enough, all right? And we're thinking about that problem. So if you have hydrogen bonding, let's say if I wanted to do glycine or I wanted to do resorcinol or anything with some kind of hydrogen bonding in there, I would need something else, some sort of internal order parameter. Okay, I don't agree with that.
Is this on?
Yes, okay. I gather that you have to know in advance what collective coordinates to use.
So, yeah,
and
I
they
said
presumably
that
have to be good ones.
Yes.
What happens if you use bad ones? Do you get garbage or do you get misleading, good-looking results?
Well, okay, so Hans, as you know, free energy is a state function. So it doesn't matter what path I use to drive you from one basin to another, all right? So if you have the wrong set of variables, it may be difficult to get from basin A to basin B, but if you can get there, you will have the right free energy difference. What you won't get, of course, is a picture of the transition states, the barriers, all right? They'll be physically meaningless. But getting from state A to state B, I can use whatever path I want, right?
But
it's a state
but you
function.
May not characterize A and B if you have the well or usefully if you don't have
okay,
the right
so
variables.
That's an independent question. So the what variables you need to characterize A and B, that's something that you have to decide a priori, obviously. Now, you know, hopefully that should be an easier problem than saying I want the full reaction path and to be able to get transition states. It doesn't mean that it's generally easy. But if I know, okay, I've got some confirmation that's folded. I mean, I don't know what it is, but, if, for example, I showed the alanine decamer and I had a very large space of variables and it was able to get me there. Maybe it was too many, but I was able to get to that folded state. So, yes, the choice of the collective variables is difficult. I think it's easier if you are just looking for key conformational states, but it doesn't mean that it's generally an easy problem. And that's, something I think that there's a lot of work being done on that.
You showed a diagram of free energies for different benzene crystal forms.
Yeah.
And I missed the part where you indicated
this. Yeah.
What temperature and pressure is that at?
Oh. Sorry, there, you see it there. We chose two gigapascals.
And 300 Kelvin.
And 300 Kelvin.
And so all of these are relatively close in free energy? Or what are the differences? That's what the scale. There must be large differences. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Right. Okay, all right.
Yeah, about 8 kcals per mole, roughly. Sorry, kilojoules per mole, thanks. No, that's just a straight absolute scale.
That surprised me that at that set of conditions you'll have these tiny differences between all these forms.
I would say, for example, that this difference is not significant. That's within the error bars. Right, exactly. But I think this one is, for example, and this one is. Those we can resolve on this time scale. That's about on the order of KT. No, that's actually bigger than KT. KT is about
KT is two and a half kilojoules per mole.
Right.
So in the adiabatic free energy dynamics, you are effectively setting up a non-equilibrium simulation with two different temperatures. Is there anything that you need to do specifically to monitor whether you really sample the right equilibrium distribution that you want to sample?
you need to be adiabatically decoupled. That's the thing that you want to check.
It's do you test that somehow?
Oh,
do you test that during the simulation, whether that's the case?
Yeah, so for example, you can look at the work that the hot system does on the cold system. And if that work is not increasing and is small, then you should have good adiabatic separation. That's one way to do it. You can also look at whether your thermostats are kind of in equilibrium. If they're not, then you don't have good adiabatic decoupling if, you know, those temperatures are not well controlled. If their distribution is distorted, you don't have good adiabatic decoupling. You have to do the same thing when you do Carparinello molecular dynamics. It's the same kind of adiabatic decoupling problem. So you want to look at these distributions and this work that one system does on the other to see whether you have a good separation or not. That's the kind of test we would do.
Basically the same question, so maybe you answered it already. You must have heat flow from the hot to the cold system. How much flow is that typically?
For the examples that we've looked at, it's very little. But we have a pretty robust thermostating scheme. Mm-hmm. The problem is that it's not zero.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we're looking at trying to do to help that is to use strict isokinetic constraints on the two systems. Mm-hmm. It really will make sure that the kinetic energy doesn't change at all. Mm-hmm. So no heat flow. Mm-hmm. I haven't done that yet, but that would be one way to kind of staunch that.
Have you ever tried to reduce the adiabatic decoupling, see what happens then?
Yeah.
What happens then?
Your free energies degrade terribly. You don't get the right answer. So you sort of have to, you know, ramp up your masses. Mm-hmm. And again, look at this heat flow that you talked about, or this work that I talked about, or these distributions that you can actually generate pretty quickly because they're just velocity distributions, and see when they go from being highly distorted to basically where you want them. And once that happens, then you say, okay, those are the parameters I want.
Can you formulate this method in terms of Monte Carlo simulations?
So maybe. The tricky thing about Monte Carlo, and I have thought about that a little bit, is I don't know if I can go back to the right slide here. Okay, I guess this is the one. What's difficult about Monte Carlo is that you have to have sort of integrated out your physical variables, and what you get is a distribution that sort of looks like this, with this power of the ratio of the two temperatures. So buried in here is, of course, an integral over your physical phase space. And so how do you do Monte Carlo on something like that? That's really not obvious. So I think of this as sort of an inherently dynamical scheme. If you could figure that out, then maybe you could do it. But there may be a way to do replica exchange this way. That's something that we're thinking about. That maybe could work. But just straight, you know, Metropolis Monte Carlo, I don't see it right away.
Because then you need to have a Hamiltonian which correspond to two parts of the system at different temperatures.
That's right, right.
Well, is it possible to use this method to build a high-dimensional free energy surface? What is it, for example, this the dimension of S?
What's a typical value of n, little n? Is that what?
Yeah.
So, you know, I showed you low-dimensional examples here, 2, 4 at the very end, and as I said, we're working on 6. Now, these are the things that you can do with sort of the most straightforward techniques, even to get 4 dimensional free energy surfaces. We need to do some tricks with sparse binning and, you know, not actually trying to cover the whole surface with bins, but just cover those regions that you visit with bins. And that works also in six dimensions. But to go beyond that, you would need some of the kinds of techniques that are probably being developed in the metadynamics community. They have ways of trying to get to these much higher dimensionalities using a variety of, you know, rather sophisticated methods.
Yeah, metadynamics cannot be used in a high dimension space, right? Yeah. Because it's exponentially increased. So, how about this method?
I think that the same kinds of methods could be used there. And when do you, you're basically just running the trajectory, and then what do? You, at the end, you have to analyze it by some set of methods, right? Normally, I don't think if n is large, I don't think you really want to map out the whole free energy landscape. What will you learn from that, right? What you really want to do is to find the key basins, the key free energy minima, the most important populated regions. And for that, you know, clustering methods seem to be okay, and there are ways of making those more robust to the value of n. So I think that's the way you want to go. You don't really want the whole free energy surface in that case.
Okay, any further questions? That's not the case at the moment. Then we can go on to the next talk. And the next talk will be by Friederike Schmid from the University in Mainz. So we will come back a little bit to the kind of topics we